The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 12 of Fixing Fight Club, Closing Thoughts on War in the 21st Century. In this 12th episode of War Notes, a conflict podcast, I wanted to welcome everybody aboard and thank you so much for your listenership and solicitude and the mountains of comments that I've got, mostly positive. I really appreciate the feedback. I have often made my academic and intellectual inquiries in the spirit of sacred cows making the best burgers and trying to view things prismatically, trying to extrapolate second and third order effects, trying to distinguish root causes from proximate causes, as in engineering. In our failure analyses that we usually do, we do start at where the failure took place and work our way back forensically to determine just how did this chaos avalanche start, this cavalcade of calamities. I've spent nearly 12 hours in my Fixing Fight Club series, for those of you who have listened from the beginning, or those of you who may have listened to certain episodes you picked out that happened to pique your interest, I've tried to make a very comprehensive case for why the Department of Defense, the departments for war making, foreign policy, foreign aid, foreign influence, and all of what's baked into the cake holistically of the American war making machine since the middle of the 19th century and moving forward. I think that I've made a very comprehensive case for why there are existential cracks in the edifice of American war making and all the narratives that you have been raised on in America for the perceived immortality and able warfighting mastery of the U.S. military complex has been a house of cards, has been a triumphalist narrative sham designed to lull you into sleep as trillions of dollars are expended on a multi-year basis going back decades, if not generations, back to the Second World War when all of this was launched afterwards in the post-colonial age with the newest instantiation of neo-colonial warfare dressed up in the skin suit of counterinsurgency, counter-guerrilla, and all of the other things that comprise irregular warfare, which I treat with much more depth and alacrity in the companion podcast to War Notes, which is Chasing Ghost in Irregular Warfare podcast. But I decided to inaugurate this particular podcast, War Notes, to allow me to escape that umbrella constraint of irregular warfare and deal with warfare across the entire spectrum. Hence the last dozen minus hours that I have spent lambasting and basically providing a very exquisite, I think, explanatory framework on why this very expensive military paper tiger known as the DOD and its war complex since the end of 1945, is not what you may think it is and is probably history's most expensive and most incapable military paper tiger. Now, with the new administration coming in, and remember, I'm a member of neither party nor a booster for anything that the awful office happens to put out, there is an opportunity here to reconstitute, reassess, and reimagine how the American martial complex will move through the remainder of the 21st century. Because as I've alluded to in the previous episodes, especially when we go back to the first three, America foundationally, strategically, and grand strategically is at a fork in the road. It can choose either to continue its unabated stalemate and defeat parade since the end of World War II, or it can take a knee, drink water, reconstitute, reassess, reevaluate, recalibrate, and from a regional hegemon complex instead of a global hegemon complex in this illusory unipolar world, which it is not conclusively that very thing, America needs to take defense seriously. I have emphasized this throughout the entire series, and in treatment of the first two episodes, I urged the powers that be, from my very plebeian perspective as an outsider and layman looking in, that a complete reimagination leaning towards defense instead of offense is going to be the ticket to U.S. and allied survival in the 21st century. Now, if we were to look at the frightened and shivering conventional and unconventional military complex in the corridors of power in the Pentagon since this new administration has come in, you would think that they were all chanting "something wicked this way comes," because that, as a matter of fact, is coming, and that would be the Department of Government Efficiency. Again, while I would call it the Department of Government Effectiveness, nonetheless, I think that what this administration has done in the first 2 weeks has shivered the foundational belief systems of the state and the deep state to their foundational cores in a way that we haven't seen in our lifetimes. And now, DOGE, that Department of Government Efficiency, is casting their gaze upon the Pentagon and will soon enter those hallowed halls to make their own evaluations. And in that spirit, I penned a letter to President Trump, SecDef Pete Hegseth, Mr. Musk, and his worthies in DOGE. I said, I am the host of Chasing Ghost, an Irregular Warfare podcast, and War Notes, a conflict podcast. You are about to embark on a dark journey to discover the existential mismanagement and beggared martial imagination of the military mandarins at the Pentagon. You have to prepare to do savage bureaucratic combat with the most financially well-endowed military machine in the history of mankind, whose penchant for defeat and stalemate has an unblemished record since 1945. Bureaucratic knife fighting and Machiavellian combat is the only martial skill they possess, and you will have to bring your concomitant best skills in those things yourself. I've distilled 10 objectives that may finally bring the Pentagon closer to being an effective fighting modality in the 21st century. Number one, you must utterly lay waste to the Joint Capabilities Integration and Development System. It's a process used by the U.S. Department of Defense to determine the requirements for military weapon systems, and is the big name with big letters about how they acquire said weapon systems. This acquisition system has managed to spend trillions of dollars on exquisite platforms and weapon systems that are always a day late and enormously and ruinously expensive. Exhibit A is the aircraft carrier, the USS Ford, which is the cross and chariot of the 21st century, as are all aircraft carriers. If the Soviets designed an acquisition system, it would look like ours. End of quote. I wanted to add that while I think the acquisition system could possibly be salvaged, I think a burning to the ground to its embers and having those embers soaked in cold water and somehow the earth salted and something else put in its place is absolutely an existentially necessary to right the ship that is heading towards the rocks and shoals as we speak. America's Department of Defense, America's conventional war machine, is designed, as so many systems and exquisite platforms are, to fight the last war in the 20th century. It is not fit for purpose to fight in the 21st century. As has been demonstrated time and again, whether the tremendous losing streak in the countries in the Middle East in exercising less than conventional war and exercising counterinsurgency and counter-guerrilla operations and other not-so-successful ventures, all the way up to recent events against Yemen in the Red Sea, where we have the U.S. Navy ham-fistedly and, I think, correctly stating that they have been engaged in the most savage naval combat since World War II, over 7 decades ago. That really says something about the state of our U.S. Navy, which I place qualitatively at the bottom tier of all U.S. all surface navies that are first world navies around the planet. It is the only blue water navy to speak of, and they are doing a terrible job of living up to the expectations and grand historical performance of World War II, which they seem savvy on emulating, but certainly not looking forward into the future with the revolutions of military affairs that are cascading inevitably across the 21st century, and they are eminently not prepared. I go on in the letter. Number two, 21st century warfare is characterized by three essential things: robotics, autonomous targeting, and the employment of hypervelocity weapon systems. End of quote. I like to remind everybody, I've come up with these three characterizations, but that doesn't mean that this is an exhaustive compendium of all that is awry and has gone wrong. I'm certain that intelligent members of my audience could show me other things that I may have missed in this regard, but we're concentrating on these three items. Quote, robotics from mud to space will not only dominate military conflict in this century through a rolling cascade of revolutions in military affairs that will dwarf such forward momentum in past history, but democratize the employment technology to the poorest countries to challenge the first world employment of exquisite platforms. End of quote, because I'd like to emphasize this. You have heard me say in both Chasing Ghost and this podcast on occasion, where I make a bifurcation, a distinction between peer and near-peer fighting. I, from this point forward, linguistically and semantically, will no longer employ the term near-peer because I think it is an anachronism, because Yemen and the Houthis in Yemen have shown that a third world country, a developing country, can be a peer to America's exquisite platforms and chase them out of the Red Sea, as they have done conclusively. So from this point forward, when you hear me say the word peer competitor instead of bifurcating with near peer competitor, I will from this point forward consider all third world countries that have savvy stratagems and operational art like the Houthis in Yemen to be peer competitors to the United States and the West. I go on. Autonomous targeting will be a necessity to remove humans in the loop because of the speed and high density of munitions aloft, which would speak to the Mach 5 plus velocities we are going to see with hypersonics. And mind you, in this century, you will see hypersonic weapons, maybe after 2050, that will exceed Mach 20, approaching Mach 30. Hypersonics are not new. Intercontinental ballistic missiles and intermediate-range ballistic missiles have been achieving hypervelocity speeds once they tip over at apogee and return into the Earth's atmosphere for going on 70 years, 75 years since the 1950s. You will note that in that time, America has not, nor has anyone else, developed a defensive modality against those incoming munitions once they have tipped. They're either MIRVed with multiple independent reentry vehicles, or they are singular munitions, but once tipped and achieving those speeds, whether terminally maneuvering or ballistically terminal or not, they cannot be intercepted with any degree of certitude by any weapon system currently deployed by the West. Not only that, that's the employment of high parabola weapons. The shallow parabola glide vehicles, like the fractional orbital bombardment systems, the FOBs that are the future, whether the U.S. and its weak allies agree or not, are certainly on the menu as items that will be offensively employed against American conventional forces. Employment and defense against them is priority one from a species perspective, and the Pentagon has failed miserably. I've cataloged hundreds of instances of this at my blog entries at the Libertarian Institute, where I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs. Number three, the role of the infantry soldier is changing in a way it has never faced in the history of manned conflict for millennia, where the technology is delivering weapons that can target individual soldiers or groups of them in a cost-effective fashion, and they can't escape their fate. And no, there will be no Heinlein-inspired armored suits for super soldiers. It makes no sense to do so when robots will fill the bill. End of quote. Now, one thing I wanted to treat here is that it breaks my heart to think that in the future we won't have the exoskeletal armor for the human meatbag soldiers that would go into them. That would be augmented whether through neural nets or augmentation of musculature or bone structure or the exaggerated carapace that they would have around them that they would use as a fighting modality to increase their resident strength. It doesn't make sense whatsoever. While I have imbibed in military science fiction since my youth and enjoyed it greatly, to include Heinlein, Purnell, and a number of other great authors of that, where they would talk about this very thing, where you would have men, these organic meatbags, in these exoskeletons and suits, it makes no sense when you can have the downsized application of computers and robotics that would be in these, and then you wouldn't have to employ survival systems or the systems that would keep humans alive within the carapace of these things. So I say with regret that that is not the direction the infantry is going as a former infantryman. I say that with the greatest sorrow, but nonetheless, what it means is that in the future, the infantry will be done by unmanned combat vehicles. Number four, the U.S. has utterly failed in aggregated fire synchronization systems that align sensors and effectors seamlessly to deliver neutralization and destruction in a peer conflict. The Russians have broken the code, and the U.S. has not. I have done some analyses of the Russian strike fires reconnaissance complex that you can find in episodes 48 and 53 of Chasing Ghosts. Number five, global hegemons always fall, always fail, even in a unipolar world in which we do not live any longer, despite the protestations by the Western elites, because nothing concentrates the mind on surviving peer conflict than defensive arrangements left a bang. The Chinese and the Russians have a distinct martial advantage as regional hegemons concentrating on both offensive and defensive stratagems synchronized together. The U.S. cannot defend its homeland from military threats, full stop. I want to pause here and take a moment to reflect on this. You will find that when you look at the Swiss Canton strategy and the Swiss defensive stratagems at both the operational and strategic level that have been employed for the last few hundred years, it fixes the mind when not only are you not a global hegemon, not even a regional hegemon, when it comes to the Swiss, for instance, their cantons were a tremendous influence on the construct of the Constitution in the founding of the United States. But what you discover is that that defensive mindset makes you pay attention to things that lend a resilience, if not a casual anti-fragility, to your preparations of not being hubristic about being able to take the fight to anything that's out there, but being able to protect yourself when the fight that you've taken doesn't succeed. Number six, the entire professional military education system from A to Z must be ruthlessly gutted and remade in the image of a system that builds fighting men encouraged to embrace risk assumption instead of risk aversion and promulgates a Prussian culture of disobedience that rewards character, initiative, and mission command from the lowest ranks, much like the German notion of Auftragsstiftung. Burn all DEI influences to the ground, soldiers' lives literally depend on their aggressive elimination with extreme prejudice. They have done nothing but provided a non-value-added distraction to the very timely resources and constrained resources that are needed to achieve the unconscious competence across the board at all levels of fighting and command that once these complex adaptive systems collide in that great war of collision with each other, whether with our allies, with our coalition forces, against enemy threats, they shouldn't have to be bothered in the finite acquisition of skills, intelligence, resources, and the sheer capability of being able to prevail in the coming fights by these social engineering confabulations that do nothing at the margin to improve American fighting ability. I am encouraged by the new administration and the DOD leadership who is trying to root out all aspects of this zampalit, this political commissar culture that DEI has insinuated like a disease vector into the body politic of the warfighting machine to cripple it to such an extent that with America's track record of not doing well in war, this is certainly not something as a value added that will help it recover from what it has experienced. Number 7, a complete reassessment and rebuilding of the military personnel performance system and a drastic reduction in the number of flag officers and their useless, bloated staffs that have been responsible for the perfect and unblemished cavalcade of calamities, failures, and stalemates since 1945 that have made this not only the most expensive paper tiger in the history of warfighting with mankind, but also, in my mind, a laughingstock to third world countries that have bested this hyper-expensive military. I don't have the expertise to fix the performance system, the training system, and all of the things that go into the promotion characterization within each of the armed forces to get the best and the brightest to the top, because that's not what has floated to the top in the past few generations, as we've seen witnessed by the concomitant failure of American arms planet-wide over the longest timeline. I would urge the Secretary of Defense to consider my friend and colleague, Mr. Donald E. Vandergriff, U.S. Army retired, who has spent the last quarter century designing the blueprint that would fix the broken performance and advancement system in the U.S. Armed Forces. Number 8, make eccentricity great again in the armed forces. Admiral Hyman Rickover and the likes of T.E. Lawrence, Ord Wingate, John Boyd, and Paul von Leto Vorbeck, the only surviving undefeated German general officer in November of 1918 on planet Earth at the time, none of these worthies and martial luminaries would have a prayer in the modern armed forces promotion circus. Let's fix that. Number 9, create vigorous red teaming and 10th man entities through all the services and the joint staff whose sole purpose is disruption, uncomfortable questions, and extrapolating the second and third order effects of every aspect of operations left of bang in after commencement of kinetic operations. End of quote. And I would add to that, let's make lessons learned not a requirement where you have a hot wash after action review and then the more sophisticated and more lengthy after action review after one's blood has become less hot after a training operation or a real combat on a two-way range, so that what we can do is finally not fill cabinets with these where they gather dust, but they actually use these lessons learned to move forward and improve the capability of the armed forces to learn from failure and mistake and struggle and become better and better and more finely honed over time. To the Army's credit, they do have CALL, a Center for Army's Lessons Learned, which I used in my middling career in the U.S. Army to great effect, because I thought to myself, wow, I've got two options here. Number one, I have this bloodless practicum of military history, and I've been a military history geek and avid reader and examiner all my life, especially my professional life, use that to my advantage. And also, I had all these lessons learned so that when my commander would say, we're going on this and this and this exercise, I had the ability to look at these things forensically because people in the past had written down all of these after-action reviews that were gathering dust that no one else read, that I read much to my benefit and the benefit of the organizations I belong to. Number 10, last but not least, force the DoD to take a knee and make defense of the homeland the first priority in everything. Considerations of defense fix the mind in a fashion that assesses heretofore unidentified gaps in knowledge and inquiry. I go on to say I have other ideas, but this is a good start. Your examination of the DoD is literally a life or death consequence for America. Make it count. Good luck and Godspeed, Bill Buppert. So that concludes the letter that I sent, and nor do I have the hubris to think that either the president, the SecDef, Mr. Musk, or Doge would even deign to read that or find it, as I am merely a layman and plebeian interlocutor and observer of these kind of affairs. So I've read you the letter, I've read you those 10 points, and I have additional points because I can do that in War Notes because I simply have the time. So in addition to all the discussions that I've had to include eliminating the Corps, to include the Army doing a wholesale reexamination of land warfare, especially manned land warfare, and the U.S. Navy and what the U.S. Navy has to do to right its ships and make things better, to include notions of what unmanned combat vehicles and UAVs are going to do to a future Air Force, and the way, for the most part, when it comes to nuclear dominance, air superiority, everything essentially mud to space, a complete reappraisal has to be done. And what I've discovered, and of course this is a particular interest of mine, is the Wehrmacht, and before that the Reichswehr, World War I, and before that the Prussian General Staff, back to 1805, they thought that military history as that bloodless practicum that I mentioned. I mean, I found myself as a professional soldier in a unique position where I had access in the English language alone, much less other languages, this vast, wide, and deep military history practicum where I could learn how ones failed, how soldiers succeeded, how armies prevailed, how said armies were defeated, and all of these things in the comfort of a comfortable chair, or I would often take these out to the field, reading them on my campaign furniture. So I found that it was very profitable for my career personally to leverage military history in my profession. I see that while the Army has an historian cohort, as it were, and publishes some brilliant stuff, I don't think at the joint staff level or the respective service level that other than forensically examining campaigns or keeping a war diary of what occurred, I don't see an active inquiry nor an active staff function in the U.S. Army, the Joint Staff, or any of the other services, where they have a military historian on staff who actively peruses left of bang, contemporary operational craft, and the military decision-making process so that one could leverage these past struggles, failures, and successes to get a better gauge of the probable or maybe possible success of ideas for conducting said campaigns. So I want you to know, with this $1 trillion budget that we currently have with the Department of Defense, and that $1 trillion budget, of course, includes some DOE set-asides for the nuclear programs that the Air Force and the Navy have, there are 3.3 million service members and DOD civilians. And I think to myself, what are some of the cells that if I were Secretary of Defense or an Assistant Secretary of Defense or an Under Secretary of Defense, what are some of the cells that I would want to see set up that may not be there? So I am happy to be corrected if my following recommendations already exist, and if they do, I'd love to know that they do. We need cells, organizations, advocacy tanks. I think that word, that phraseology of think tank is silly. Those are advocacy tanks because they are in the tank for what they are the champions of. So let's just be full disclosure and not beat around the bush about what they're really about. So the following cells, the following organizations, the following small intellectual pursuit engines should be stood up immediately by the current SecDef if he can't find them in existence already. We need a cell created, probably at the joint level, that simply examines defense, that puts defense in the second D in the Department of Defense and looks at all the prioritized programs, mission sets, both instantiated now, and mission sets that would increase the security of the homeland, and make that a discrete modality in which all of that is pursued, and then a template is offered to the Secretary of Defense, and hence the President, that delineates what that defensive posture would look like. Because right now, that defensive posture is sitting at zero. Of course, some of the naysayers will say, but Bill, we have a mid-course interceptor program with 44 mid-course interceptors that are ready to slay any ICBMs or IRBMs that dare to reach apogee, tilt, and send their lethal munitions onto the surface of the American homeland. And as I discussed in previous episodes concerning the nuclear inventory and the capability to defend against such, with a probability of kill of over 90% demanding four of those munitions lofted to intercept the MIRVs before they tip and released their deadly payloads, that of those 44, 11 of them would go after a single incoming ICBM or IRBM before it tipped. I suspect that when you look at Chinese and Russian inventories, and there are plenty of other countries, especially when you consider fractional orbital bombardment systems being a little less sophisticated and expensive for third world nations that seek to have that capability, that system would be quickly overwhelmed, and one has to scratch one's head and say to yourself, well, wait, why do you only have 44 to intercept the MIRV before it tips? Because remember, after it tips, we have no capability whatsoever to defend against incoming hypervelocity munitions. Not a priority for the Department of Defense. We need to take all the respective service and joint military history complexes that are out there, and maybe even reach into the university, and after we've wrung their necks and told them to get their stuff together when it comes to delivering quality professional military education that is not freighted and burdened by DEI and other socialist engineering BS that has been plugged into the entire modality and apparatus of the higher education system for both the enlisted and officer corps in the U.S. Armed Forces, one would find the time, maybe even the folks who are genuinely interested in showing how a rigid, deep, and less than shallow application of military history would yield great rewards to those who are paying attention. Because obviously, with a pristine record of failure, stalemate, and defeat since 1945, maybe it's time to do a reassessment of what history has told us before so that we can avoid, left of bang, making those mistakes continuing into the 21st century. The Secretary of Defense apparently has an irregular warfare bureaucracy. It's run by West Point. I have discovered nothing worthwhile. It's all a bunch of triumphalist drivel that tends to use whole-of-government policy prognostications not to fix what's not been done well before, but to put a rosy picture and put bright paint on what is otherwise a rather dilapidated irregular warfare modality in the entirety of the DoD to include the special operations. Another consideration is a wholesale stand down of all covert and clandestine action by the intelligence community planet-wide, much less what it appears to be doing domestically, so that one can do a full reappraisal and reassessment of the second and third order effects of color revolutions conducted around the world, for instance, and whether, in the end, that serves America's defensive interest. As a matter of fact, does it make the countries that have been actively suborned, does it make them neutral or beneficial to the national security of the United States? I don't propose to have the answer. What I propose is that we examine that again with a 10th man, contrarian, or skeptical eye to see if there is utility to it. I get it. The James Bond stuff, the covert action stuff, the Hollywoodized appearance of doing the cloak and dagger things for God and country. And in the end, the bright, shining lie told to all of us is that this interference overseas makes us safer at home. I would suggest to you that there are volumes out there that prove that it is completely otherwise. And that, as we know, Newton's third law is a stone-cold motherfracker. And what we discover over time is that what empires do, and there's no doubt that the United States is an empire, whatever empires do abroad, it always comes home. Hence, a lot of the political turbulence that all of us, regardless of your party affiliation or philosophical touchstone, you will discover that it doesn't always end well. And I would suggest to you that the majority of the time we tend to have this grenade go off in America's pants with the pin taken out by the very people wielding it. And here we are at this critical juncture. So I would urge you to take a look at the first 11 episodes of this Fixing Fight Club series in War Notes. If this just happens to be the first one you've listened to, you will find among them, for instance, episode 3 is The Joint Illusion. Episode 4 is Intelligence Failure is a Feature, Not a Bug. Episode 6 is Escalation, Dominance, and Salvo Competition. I cover the different respective services. No, I have not addressed Space Force. No, I have not addressed SOCOM. That may happen in a future series because my intent was, with a bone in my teeth, to offer up suggestions and a path forward to fix what is clearly bankrupt, lacking in martial imagination, spending like drunken sailors on systems and exquisite platforms that will find themselves, let's say, like the aircraft carrier, future fish apartments that will be the gravestones for thousands of drowned sailors. I don't want to see any of that happen, but we are on a collision course as we speak with this most expensive paper tiger in the history of mankind and the constant sword rattling by the U.S. and allied ruling classes, thinking that war is always the answer and discovering time and again that, well, maybe not only is it not the answer, but you're not coming to the fight with the weapons, the systems, the tactics, techniques, and procedures, and the operations and the stratagem considerations that would make you successful. Otherwise, you would not have this unblemished record of failure. My plea is simple. If you agree with me, and thank you for that, spread the word, not simply about my podcast. This is bigger than me. This is bigger than you. Spread the word about the fact that we need to address this soonest, not later. We are not venologists when it comes to this. We are not wine growers where it gets better over time. None of this kind of martial neglect and incompetence gets better with time. It simply gets worse, especially when it is harnessed to a political system that inevitably, and for some reason I can't put my finger on, is always trying to pick a fight. Sometimes while deployed overseas, in my most cynical moods, I would think that, wow, American war-making and war-fighting seems to be a very sophisticated money-laundering complex for the military-industrial complex in the West. The things I saw, the things my colleagues in uniform and not in uniform who over there saw, the things you in my audience who may have happened to have been in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, in the Horn of Africa, in Grenada, in all of these different places around the globe, you saw things that you would never forget. Those of you on two-way ranges, I know you are burdened, whether you acknowledge it or not, by moral injury as a result of the things that you did and the load that you carried. And brother, I am there. I understand precisely what's going on in the darkest nights of your soul. So my ask is rather simple. Let's find a way to go to the DOD and go to the war-making apparatus in the United States and look them in the eye and say, it's time to reassess, it's time to recalibrate, it's time for us to reconsider, to wonder at our place in the world, wonder at our use of hard power aligned to soft power, and wonder at a unipolar world that is quickly disintegrating, dissolving before our very eyes, where it will no longer be a unipolar world, no matter what the U.S. makes it out to be with official gaslighting and protestations otherwise. So with that, that concludes my Fixing Fight Club series. I hope those of you who have listened to every episode enjoyed it. Those of you who listened to episodes that you chose a la carte found something of value in them. And those of you who slogged it out all the way from the first episode to this last one, I salute you to your patience and forbearance for bearing with me in this exegesis, this catharsis that I had in trying to find a way out of the box that we find ourselves in as a country. Again, I am so grateful for your listenership and solicitude. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can write me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You can find me on your favorite podcast vendor. If I don't happen to be on that podcast vendor, let me know, and I will make sure that I fix that. If said podcast vendors that you listen to happen to have the ability to put stars, recommendations, or reviews on there, I would be forever obliged if you took the time to do so. And I wanted to reach out and thank my 46 paid subscribers. Remember, you have never heard me have my hat in hand asking for you to separate yourself from your hard-earned dollars, and you will not hear it from me, but for those who took the extra step and went the extra kilometer to part with their hard-earned dollars to support my efforts here on Substack, you will find my Chasing Ghost Substack, which will be in the show notes along with some book recommendations. So for those of you who have slogged through these with me, I thank you and salute you, and this is Bill out.